Hello, and a very warm welcome to No Heathen Land, a podcast retelling macabre, intriguing, and just plain weird stories from the past, from God's own country, Yorkshire. In my opinion, Yorkshire is the perfect breeding ground for the most weird and wonderful tales. In Yorkshire, we have the rolling, vast countryside of the dales, dark, tangled woodlands, remote back roads, but also industry, hard labour, a history of staunch religion, farming, tight-knit communities, immigration, a welcoming attitude, intolerance, riots. Much of this documented, a vast amount not. It's the stories in between the newspaper headlines that I really want to get into. Through my experience working in local history, it's really quite surprising how many odd tales you come across simply by looking into one single person's family history, for example. A newspaper article, a diary entry, a theatre playbill, a photograph. I'm very lucky to have made friendships and connections with interesting and enthusiastic people right here in Yorkshire. Each episode will feature one of them as a very special guest, where we'll delve into some of the stories we've come across that have fascinated, baffled, and sometimes unnerved us. Because of the subject nature of this podcast, some stories will not be suitable for everyone. Approach with caution. Hello, and welcome to No Heathen Land, episode 10! 10. I don't think I've ever consistently done anything like semi-professional 10 times in a row. And for no real reason, other than it's fun and kind of challenging. So I'm pretty proud of myself. Thank you so much for listening, whether you've listened from the first episode, or this is your first time listening, or you've listened to two episodes or three. I don't mind. Thank you for being here. I really appreciate it. So self-congratulations aside, for my 10th episode, my guest is Sean Page. Sean, otherwise known as Warehouse 606, is a multi-skilled digital creator based in Leeds, a photographer, graphic designer, writer, and local history enthusiast. It's Sean's enthusiasm that drew me to his social media and got us chatting a couple of years ago, and we've since become friends. Sean's research into Leeds' hidden history has been channeled into his writing and into his podcast Leeds Echoes, an excellently produced series of short episodes on aspects of Leeds, often overlooked in traditional local history research. I'll leave it at that. We do talk about it a little bit more in the episode and at the end, but you should go listen. Without going too much into the theme of this episode, I just wanted to give an extra content warning. Most of the stories on this podcast are quite dark as a rule, but in this episode we discuss stories about suicide which might not be suitable for some listeners. So if that's not for you, just skip this one. Also, as always, would it be an episode of No Heathen Land if there wasn't some kind of sound issue? It's not an issue. We recorded this in a library, in and sort of like an empty room. It's quite echoey, which I don't think is a problem. But we were right next to the town hall, and the clock chimes really loudly, which again I think kind of adds to it. And there was a couple of sirens. So hopefully it's not too distracting. Just wanted to point it out. So I'll be back at the end with info where to find out more about the show and more about Sean. But now, on with episode 10. Hi, Sean.
Hi.
And welcome to No Heathen Land. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. This is the 10th episode of No Heathen Land. And I think I've been trying to get you on the podcast for ages. But it's quite nice that it's ended up being the 10th one.
I'm glad I've been irritatingly unavailable.
Yeah. Everyone has, it's fine. But you're here now, which is exciting. So we kind of met through Instagram, I think.
Yes.
So I was trying to remember how I found you, and I found you from one of my friends must have followed you and said that you were at the Leeds BLM protest.
Right, that makes
or
sense.
It might have been the counter protest.
Nah.
And you had made some Instagram stories that were interesting.
Yes, no,
I remember watching them thinking, oh, you seem interesting. And then
totally sort of unrelated, I was buying a gift for one of my local history friends, and it was a print that I found, and it happened to be one of yours.
Yes. Yes.
Because you are a multi-talented person.
Apparently. So they tell me.
Yeah, you are. So would you mind saying a little bit about who you are and what you do and how you kind of have become aligned with sort of local history stuff?
Yeah. Well, I'm Sean, obviously. I came up to Yorkshire about 10 years ago to do university and have ended up kind of getting really involved in digital media production and creation, and I've always kind of been interested in local history, and I was always really keen to learn more about Leeds, which was like a new place for me, like a new home, and I guess everything kind of like gradually melded together.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, like the history has kind of become like a massive core thing of like what I try and do now, really. I was really surprised, I think, of how hungry people were on Instagram for like local heritage content and stuff, which is super, super cool. And yeah, like I just have kept going, really, and now I'm kind of here. And
I'm
trying not to question it too much, but no, yeah, it's good.
Yeah, I think in the past couple of years, definitely, even over the like year and a half that I've known you, sort of, you seem to have worked really hard and become quite well known for some of the things that you've done. So you're quite heavily involved in Corn Exchange, yes. And you've also become a member of the Council for the Thoresby Society, which is a big deal.
Yes, super, super lucky. The Thoresby Society has been really, really receptive to my offer of trying to do the stuff that's really, really hard if you don't like half the time inadvertently have the skills to do it, like websites and like a lot of it is just like trying to get visibility, I think, and the end goal for everyone is just for more people to see it and more people to enjoy it, I think, like and it can be a little bit painful getting there sometimes when it involves like building a good website and it can get wildly subjective as well, and everyone, when it comes to local history, suddenly everyone has an opinion and quite a strong one.
I think you, like personality-wise, you're quite a good person to be infiltrating this world, though, because we don't have a lot of people that are visible that will shout about things that might be swept under the carpet otherwise, without getting too political about it.
Yeah, I try and there's time and a place for politics, but I think with local history, as with a lot of local issues, it tends to like feel like it transcends a lot of the left-right stuff, because it's like there's only one right way to protect a book. There's only one right way to make sure people can have access, you know, to some degree. So it tends to be like, yeah, I'm really willing to shout about stuff because it's just cut through the nonsense and just be like, no, like everyone wants books to be saved, so like let's just focus on doing that. And I just don't like big sticker for like injustice, and like especially when it's one that like it feels like no one's going to talk about. It's almost like I'll go out of my way to be like, okay, well I'm going to shout about that.
Definitely. And I think without maligning older people who are interested in local history and have, you know, been stalwarts of local history for a very, very long time, it's quite nice to come in as younger people, and by younger, I mean like maybe under 50.
It's a high bar that's set for
Is refreshing, and I think that's why you've been welcomed with open arms, for example, at Thoresby.
They're lovely people. I'm very, very lucky.
Yeah. So, I wanted to ask, so seeing as you are not from Yorkshire, which, yet another person on the podcast not from Yorkshire, you may be like, this is the 10th episode and you're maybe like the 5th person that's not from Yorkshire, maybe the 6th. So I know that you're mostly, well, pretty much solely focused on Leeds as an interest. But why do you think, or do you think, that Yorkshire, or Leeds in particular, if you prefer that, is unique and so interesting to look into the history of? and why do you think so many stories come out of it and it's so sort of like prolific, I guess, in the local history world?
I think one sits inside the other. I think Leeds sits inside Yorkshire in the same respect. A lot of what makes Leeds interesting is lent and borrowed from what makes Yorkshire interesting. It's a place that has a really, really strong identity. It's a place mm-hmm. that knows very, very much who it is. And might sound kind of obvious, but like coming from the home counties and coming from a very new town, Wellingarden City, it's not a given that an area knows where it is and what it is and who it is. It feels like vast swaths of Hertfordshire, Bedfordshire, Buckinghamshire particularly don't have much of a cohesive identity. Certainly a lot of the towns maybe don't. It sort of ends up getting split down into very, very small areas, or much, much wider, like the, you know, half the county might kind of have an identity. But yeah, there's something about Yorkshire that's like quite specific. I mean, not completely unique. There's other, you know, there's large areas of the north that share this same thing of they have quite sort of unique identities, and whether it comes from years and years of being sort of maligned by central government and everything being so London-centric that it's encouraged and sort of poured fuel on that whole being unique and being true to sort of like who you are, or just understanding that identity. Sometimes it can help to know what you're not, to know who you are. And I think the North does quite well in knowing, well, we're not that, we're not London, so it's a good place to work back from to start figuring out, like, well, who are we then?
Yeah, I like that. That's nice.
And yeah, I think Leeds is just, for me, that Yorkshire quirkiness and that Yorkshire identity, like, distilled into, like, a highly urban environment. There's lots of Leeds' development that's super, super shared with loads of other cities, but there's also loads of things that seem to be bizarrely unique to Leeds. Like, mm-hmm. it's always had this attitude of, we know what we're doing, and it doesn't matter if no one else happens to be doing it or we're the last people still doing it. We know it's a good idea, so we're going to carry on anyway. Yeah. Like the back-to-backs, like the tram, like mm-hmm. Leeds has this habit of holding on to stuff that it thinks was a good idea for a good like two decades longer.
Yeah,
and there's an element of stubbornness to there, but there's also most of the times that that's happened, they've been right, and it's been a damn good idea, and they've had the kind of part of its identity, I think, has given it the power to dig its heels in and go, I don't care what Manchester's doing, or London, or Hull, or anyone else for that matter. If we think it's a good idea, we're going to carry on.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that seems to be very much like something that keeps coming up. And I really, really like that. I don't know, as someone who's felt a bit identityless and a bit homeless, not literally, thank goodness, but for never ever quite feeling or knowing where I fit in, I've always super, super respected the confidence of Leeds and Yorkshire in knowing who it is, and that's like living here has super, super helped for me to like embrace that within myself and to like know who I am. So yeah. I'm very, very thankful.
That's lovely. That was a great speech.
Sorry,
I'm trying. I was being sincere. So we always like to bring it back to something weird, because that is what the podcast is about. So Sean has very kindly sent me three very large documents of of articles, which I really wish that I had more time to read through them. But do you want to tell the podcast what these documents are and how you found them? And, you know, like, why they're... Well, I mean, I think it'll become quite apparent that they're quite odd and a little bit depressing. There will be probably a small trigger warning before this that I'll have already put in.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, it's three PDFs that I came across quite a few years ago now. I feel like I've had hold of them for about 6 or 7 years. There wasn't much context, if any, I don't think, from where they were hosted. I think they were online as part of maybe like a bibliography or a reference to someone's wider thesis or study, but the way they'd been hosted, rather than being like embedded on that page, they'd just been hosted on a random storage server, I think. So from the URL, I couldn't even figure out the organisation that they might have belonged to, or the university or anything. Mm-hmm. So it is just three PDFs that look very much like the search results for the Yorkshire Evening Post. I know it's the Yorkshire Evening Post and the Yorkshire Post. And I think it's the outcome of a search of their archives from between 1890 covering to about 1950. And judging from the contents of all of these search results, I think the search term definitely involved both the canal and the river. I think maybe there was an additional search term of something grim, maybe like death or murder, or because an awful lot of the articles, do relate to just dead bodies being washed up in both the canal and the river, and a lot of gruesomeness. So whether it's a little bit of that they were quite gruesome anyway back then, or whether it was just that, there was definitely an additional gruesome search term that's in the return at all.
Yeah. So when you found these, what were you looking for?
I assume that I was just looking for either the canal, the Leeds-Liverpool canal, or the River Aire. And I probably... It might have been that I was searching for the Leeds-Liverpool canal, and I was searching for a particular phrase, maybe not that ordering, like Liverpool-Leeds, some way of doing it, but I'd put it in parenthesis so it searched the exact term.
Okay.
And I think that's why I've sort of returned them now and never really stumbled across them since, because I think it's sort of like a really specific term for the canal that's like returned them. I think it was when I was doing research just years ago, trying to figure out what the canal was and why it was there.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, right. So there's a lot of these articles, so each document is like between 25 and 50 pages. There's three documents. So there's quite a lot, and then there's a lot of articles in each one. So from what I've seen, we'd said that these kind of articles fall into maybe three or four categories.
Mm-hmm.
So there seems to be a category for women or wives that had fallen off boats or into the canal. There seems to be industrial aligned accidents,
mm-hmm.
and there seems to be suicide.
Mm-hmm.
So could you give, this is going to be like a very big overview, but sort of a little bit of background context to how important the waterways are in this area of Yorkshire, in Leeds, between, say, the 1890s and the 1950s, because we can do a comparison a bit later on, but they're nothing like this now. And why this is so significant is because you just don't see this many articles in such a short space of time about death in water.
It seems to cover quite a particular stretch of it as well. It almost seems to exclusively cover from like Shipley through to like just past the city centre the other side, which is the River Aire obviously has the canal, the Leeds-Liverpool canal that runs parallel to it. And over this time period, they were unbelievably intensive hives of industrial activity. The canal at this stretch by Kirkstall in Leeds particularly was massive coal shipments to both Kirkstall Power Station and Whitehall Power Station in the centre, as well as others, and supplying it to businesses and homes. And they were busy, they were not really very nice places, I would imagine. They were places of work, and they were places of very heavy industrial work, which isn't grim, which isn't very great now, but 100, 150 years ago it was probably really nasty.
Yeah. So what I was going to do was choose a few random ones, read them out, and then we can have a little discussion of them. Does that sound all right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay. So, the very first one already jumped out at me. So the first one, so this is from the Yorkshire Evening Post, and this is the 3rd of December 1890. An inquest was held yesterday on the body of Sarah Jackson, 37, the wife of a canal boatman. Deceased had only arrived in Salford when she went ashore with him, and returning to the flat some little time before, the deceased is believed to have missed her footing in the darkness and fell into the canal. Search was made for a body, which was found near the shoreside. A verdict of found drowned was returned. So this is actually around more like Manchester Salford way, but I'm guessing they've come from here. So what I found from skimming these articles is like this seems like it happens a lot. of women losing their footings and falling into the canal in the dark.
Yeah.
But that's suspicious to me.
Yeah, I mean, you do get the feeling that the waterways were probably an amazingly convenient place to hide a body.
Yes.
The canal's an interesting one, because the canal is not particularly very deep. I can't remember the exact dimensions, but it's pretty consistent, the dimensions from all the way from Leeds to Liverpool on that canal until the city centre. Obviously, the Coalsdale Canal is a little bit different, but the Leeds-Liverpool Canal is probably about 10, 15 feet wide, and then probably about 10 feet deep, 15 feet deep at the deepest. The base of the canal bed is like an inverted triangle.
Yeah.
So the middle is the very, very deepest, and then it gets sort of shallower up to the side. So it's not a particularly large volume of water. You know, on a sunny day now, you can see the bottom. And you do often think, looking at this article, a lot of these articles, how anyone successfully drowns in water that you would probably be able to stand up in for the majority of it.
So
they feel super suspicious, but then at the same time, you think about the kind of clothing that people were wearing, was potentially a lot heavier and a lot denser and a lot more difficult to move about and in water compared to what we wear now. And I really don't think, I think there was, despite a lot of people working on the water, it feels like a lot of people really didn't know how to swim.
I think that will be a huge part of this, that people couldn't swim. They say you can drown in a puddle.
I mean, I suppose, yeah, you could technically. And another thing as well, in terms of, I think the point I was probably originally trying to make about hiding bodies was, despite it being a very shallow body of water, the canal, it probably would have been opaque with how filthy it would have been.
Oh, yeah.
And even just the continuous movement of vehicles throughout it, which there isn't now, would have caused such excitation of the water constantly that all the silt would have been moving around. And because the other thing that jumps out at me of that description of that article was, if she missed her footing and fell, why was a search needed for, you know, if you imagine someone falling into the canal today, there would be no search needed for the body if you saw where they fell in, because they would just still be there, because there's no current, there's no tide, it's completely still water.
Yeah.
So the fact that she was somehow disappeared and then found by the shore side, it almost, feels a bit like, that you would buy that in a river because the current would have moved her along, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, so it seems wildly suspicious, a lot of these, where they're sort of forgetting that, but it's a canal. The water's not moving anywhere.
Yeah, that's true. Right, let's choose one from a little bit later. So, here we go. So, this is between 1901 and 1920. Okay, another theme is drinking. So, we've got 28th of May 1902. 30th of May 1902, a Leeds shoemaker's death. This morning, the body of Matthew Machin, 52, shoemaker, late of Funslet Road, was found in the New Dock Basin, Chadwick Street, Leeds, by John Buckley, boatman. There was a wound to his throat, 2 inches long and 1.5 inches deep. Machin is stated to have been drinking heavily of late, and the supposition that he committed suicide. The body was identified by his brother at the mortuary. Again, that sounds well sus.
Yeah, an interesting way to try and commit suicide, by doing a 2-inch wound in your own throat.
So there are a lot of these kind of, someone was drinking and supposed to lost their footing, but then they've got this other injury as well. I've seen that pop up a few times. But I guess this is a peril of drinking near a canal, or if you have to walk down the canal.
Yes.
And not being able to swim. But also, I do think that is quite a suspicious one.
Yes. It's interesting, a lot of the people where misfortune has befallen them, particularly in Leeds, in all of these articles, a lot of them are from Hunslet.
I found that too, when I had a look through.
I think it's probably a combination of Hunslet's location and the type of industry it had there. It probably was an awful lot of canal workers and boatmen did potentially have accommodation there, ones that didn't. I mean, a lot of these workers did live on the water, essentially. It's interesting to think of how police work and investigation has come a long way, because it seems to be that a lot of these people aren't even... They're not even... acting like they're suspicious. No, it's not like, oh, this is suspicious, but we have no technology to prove it. Like, we're not even bothering suspicion anymore.
Yeah,
it is interesting how cut and dry a lot of it is reported as being like, oh, this wildly this crazy thing happened, and that's the way it is.
Here's your three lines in the paper about it. Mm. Maybe we're just so used to all the sensationalism around. I mean, if this kind of thing happened now, you know, you'd get days and days more. Not that you shouldn't, but we'd get, you know, just be a lot more coverage. But what struck me about these, what I think I said to you yesterday, is that they're like every other day.
The frequency is just astounding. Yeah.
So we've got what I'm looking at now, 1903, 13th of June, 18th of June, 24th of June, all together. All
each
to do
one
with
is
drownings.
A different body, a different person, a different life extinguished. The main takeaway I got from gradually going over the whole set of documents was just how much more likely you were to drown, apparently. Again, I have no idea of the statistics, but anecdotally, it feels like that is one of the rarest ways you hear about people dying nowadays is drowning. It is like a really rare incident.
Yeah.
Like you said, it gets quite a lot of press coverage. It's either someone who's tragically fallen in, say, the sea,
that's what I was going to say.
When it's the river locally, it tends to horribly be like a child who's fallen in a terrible accident. Mm. And whilst there are a fair few instances in these PDFs of children drowning during this period, it's overwhelmingly adults, it seems.
Yeah.
So, which is.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've just found an example of sort of a more industrial one. So, we've got 4th of February 1927, mm-hmm. Wakefield Boatman's fate. The body of Thomas Bolton, boatman of Wakefield, was recovered from the canal at Thornfield this morning. It stated that yesterday, while he was pulling a boat under a bridge, the boat lurched and he was jerked into the water.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of absence of. I mean, there would have been no health and safety legislation or rules. I mean, companies would have been completely left to decide this for themselves. And a lot of these men, to my understanding, were self-employed. They were independent business owners. The boat was the business, essentially. I think there was. Did it say about the pin not having been secured in the normal way? And
Definitely some of them.
Yeah.
Some of them had that for that article.
Yeah. So it's it's like they were best practices and they did know, and it, I don't know, again, another takeaway I had reading this, and it's something I do frequently. I'm not a huge stickler for the rules, but when a lot of people endlessly huff and puff about health and safety and legislation stuff, my response or my thinking a lot of the time, I suppose because I've done so much historical research over these periods, you know, a lot of the over the top or feeling like over the top health and safety policy we have today is the end legacy response of trying to deal with stuff like this. You know, how big they were on trying to teach me to swim as a child when I was in school, and clearly that is, you know, still a legacy throwback from trying to control suddenly. Yeah. Loads of kids are drowning all the time because suddenly we're in cities and it's busy and we're all on the water, and so it's the fact that they knew and had best practices and people didn't follow them and stuff, it's very Wild Westy. It's very kind of like your life is in your own hands, and if you decide not to do it, then what will befall you will befall you.
So we've got another dying at work. And then there's a Leeds boy drowned, so this is 1937. Leeds boy drowned, fell 15 feet into the canal while at play. In an unsuccessful attempt to revive a boy taken from the canal at Springs Garden Locks near Wellington Bridge, Leeds, last night, police and civilians worked with oxygen apparatus for over an hour. The boy was Henry Johnson, 11, of Woodsley Road. He fell about 15 feet into the lock while watching wood he had thrown into the water. That's so sad. A large boatman attracted the cries of other children. Someone, Mr. Jack Smith, that sounds like a made-up name, a lock keeper who, with a boat hook, recovered the body from 10 feet deep. And that's 1937, but you can see the comparison of that article where they've got oxygen and they get people to help.
Yeah.
To the other ones where it's like, someone slipped, now they're dead.
It seems to be, as the time went on, certainly post the start of the 20th century, the industrial accidents became less, the suspicious stuff becomes less, and it does start to become more tragic children accidents and a lot of unsupervised children playing in the banks. The boat hook comes up time and time again. Mm. Like, I don't think I've even seen a boat hook before. I can't even really picture one, but...
I think I'm thinking of like, I don't know, maybe I have seen one.
But they say that...
And they're the ones that have got like a huge hook on it, but they're not sharp.
I would guess. But whatever they are, they seem to be synonymous with being on every boat. They're obviously a core part of how you move them about or you know, navigating the canal. But it's always, they were fished out with a boat hook. Mm-hmm. And very often, I don't know if, again, this leads into that theory of not many people could swim, but a lot of the people doing the rescuing, it's not their first time. I think there's a couple of articles in here of people on their 150th documented rescue from the river and canal. And these guys are only in their mid-20s.
Yeah.
So whether it is that they just work there and are always right place at right time, or it's the extra combination of they also happen to be the only ones that can confidently swim. But it seems to be a lot of the rescuers are serial rescuers.
I've just found a really interesting one. Mm-hmm. So we've got 18th of November 1939, blackout accidents in Leeds area, so this is 39. Pedestrian who walked into river. The blackout in Leeds district overnight, aided and abetted by slight fog, for the second time this week, produced a crop of accidents. Henry Thompson, 34, from Ascot Street, Pontefract Lane, was walking along the banks of the River Aire, near the end of Goodman Street, Hunslet, again, when he fell in the river. He was helped out by two of the water by a boatman, Charles Ray, of Montague Street, Doncaster, HCAP 2 of Goodman Street, and two police officers who had heard his cries had great difficulty in finding him in the pitch blackness. He was admitted to Seacroft Hospital, suffering from shock of immersion, and is stated today to be quite comfortable.
Good. I'm glad it worked out.
Yeah. That's such an interesting take, though, that the blackout, that he was like, I'm going to go for a walk into the water.
It seems, I mean, when you start going back to the earlier ones as well, I think it's a reminder of how much artificial light there is everywhere now.
Yes.
I suppose people that are listening to this from further out in the country, you know, will know. It's something I get starkly reminded of whenever I leave Leeds and go to the Dales or something.
Yeah.
Suddenly dark means dark. And you read, because a lot of these articles are just, he left the pub and went to walk home and we never saw him again, and we assumed he just fell in and drowned. I mean, that sounds laughable now, doesn't it? Someone just
But you literally wouldn't be able to see.
No, not at all. Those blackouts were very, very common as well.
Yeah.
It seemed to be that a lot of the freezing fog that happened down in the air would cause like arcing of the switches when they would try and turn them off.
Okay.
And cause these like cascade faults throughout the system.
The
9th of May 1913, Hunslet woman who had, quote, nothing to live for. A boatman named Walter Clarkson was working on a barge on the River Aire at Hunslet yesterday afternoon when he heard screams and a minute later saw a woman struggling in the water. He got, again, a large boat hook and pulled the woman out of the river. She was placed on the bank and first aid was administered by Police Sergeant Spencer. When she recovered, she was taken to Hunslet Police Station, where she was supplied with dry clothing and attended to by a doctor. Mm. This morning, the woman, whose name is Eva Ryder, 38, of Hillage Street, Hunslet, was charged at Leeds City Police Station with attempting to commit suicide. In reply to the charge, she says, "I have nothing left to live for." The accused, it was stated, was living with her father, a man of 74, and was of weak intellect.
That's so sad.
It is really, really sad. And good to note that it was still a crime.
Yeah, one that makes it so much...
Women were disproportionately prosecuted for over men as well.
Yeah, there were a few... There was one that I was trying to look for then, and it was one where a woman had... just kept saying that she had issues, and she had tried to drown herself several times. So she would drink a lot and then she would try and drown herself and then get pulled out again, and sort of made it into sort of like a game, but it's pretty messed up game. But probably because she's just not doing great. But the way that they would deal with that is to charge them.
Yeah.
So yeah, it does seem to be mostly women as well in these that do this.
I think it's a long history of criminalising behaviour that we just can't be bothered to deal with properly. A bit like drug use now, in a way.
Yeah.
It's a bit easier to go, ah, than actually help them. And yeah, again, another woman from Hunslet, and yeah, the desperation that you must be in to attempt to drown yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's, again, a bit of a change in the times, because now that seems like a crazy way to attempt to do it. And
yeah.
I don't know if it's mainly because 100 years ago that was a better option, or was a practical option because we didn't have all the extra stuff you have now. But I mean, you would have had plenty of access potentially to wild drugs and intoxicants. I mean, we were still putting cocaine and heroin in cough medicine at this point.
Mm.
So it seems really interesting that a lot of people are choosing. I mean, it tends to be a lot of women reported in this article who were attempting suicide, usually hysterical. And I wonder if a lot of the time the attempted suicide is a label that is placed upon them.
Absolutely.
And maybe they are just in psychological distress, or just freaking out and choose to jump into the water. And it might be that they wouldn't mind if they did die, but it might not be as in whether we would see it as an attempt at suicide now as being a very specific attempt to extinguish your life and nothing else. These almost seem like cries for help, almost literally, in a sense, maybe. And yeah, maybe it is people that are just, rather than being mentally ill or really depressed, they're people that are desperate and feeling like they've got no other choice. And
yeah, I think from a couple that were similar, definitely one that I can think of that was quite an early one. This woman that sort of had done the same thing several times. The articles were quite long, and they would include like the things that she'd said, and she'd sort of made a joke out of it, like I said, at the end. But then she'd probably do the same thing again.
Yeah. I mean, it is. There's so many unknowns that today would be identified. You know, so many of these people could be suffering from a wild variety of both temporary and permanent mental illnesses that are going to be completely undetected. And yeah, it's really interesting, and the pinch of salt that you have to take them all with, knowing that those words have been written by people with so little interest potentially in the well-being and the reality of the situation, maybe, as well.
There are a few that I noticed as well in the earlier document that were young women, young as in like 17, 18 young, that had gone missing, and they were assuming that they were in the canal. I'm just looking at one here, which is in Murfield. Since 20 minutes past 6 on Sunday morning, Elizabeth Ann North, age 18, cotton reeler, daughter of George Jagger North, boatman, Bayfield, has been missing. She left home at the time stated to go to her work at Clive Mills Murfield and did not get there. She's not been seen or heard of since. It is feared that she had committed suicide, as she did say that on the night of the 22nd, insisted that she would drown herself if her mother complained to her about not having enough money.
It's strange. It does seem to almost be a, I don't know, trying not to get too morbid and try to choose my words carefully. Maybe today, it feels like one of the, what pops into a lot of people's heads when you say attempted suicide today is people tend to think hangings. And I feel like maybe this is a little bit like that 100 years ago, the go-to thing that people thought of when they thought of suicide, or maybe even death, was the water, was
absolutely
drowning. Was, and so maybe that's why there's this attempted, this repeated sort of like notion of like, oh, I'll just go drown myself then, I'll just go. Well, I wonder if it was almost like an expression, or it had almost become an expression to a point.
So the one underneath, 3 weeks later, it's not the same person. Attempted suicide in Leeds last night. A woman named Elizabeth Ryder, 29 years of age, lodging with James Gregory of 10 Organ Yard, Low Road, Hunslet, again jumped into the River Aire about 6:30 near Eshot Wharf, Old Mill Lane, Hunslet, with the intention of committing suicide. She was fortunately seen by Charles Fordham, a boatman of Dealney Ferrybridge, whose boat was lying in the wharf, and rescued her. He handed her over to the care of bystanders, whom she said was taken home and communicated with the police. Investigations showed that she had been a patient at Leeds Infirmary, and Dr. Nicholson, who was called in, said that she must be closely watched and would have been taken either to the workhouse or asylum. The police did not, therefore, take her into custody, which sounds worse.
Yeah, that's still pretty awful.
That's pretty bad, yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, very sad. I feel like we should find a happy one, but I don't know if there is one.
No, I mean, there was...
There's some good hero ones, someone fought, like people falling in and then some boatmen jumping in. There was one where someone's brother jumped in to save them, which is quite nice.
Okay, I'll give you this one. A Leeds solicitor and his peacock. 11th of May, 1891. Today at the Wakefield Courthouse, William Fieldhouse, boat captain, John Turpin, a boatman, and Benjamin Pease, a horse driver, were charged with stealing a peacock, value 30 shillings, that was the property of Mr. Clifford Dunn, solicitor in Leeds, who resides in Methley, which the canal and river both like snake through.
Yeah.
On the date named, three little girls who were walking on the canal side of Methley saw the defendant Turpin carrying the bird, and Pease had hold of its tail. I like the fact that two men were both like jointly carrying this peacock running up the canal.
We just did the action to hold it in the peacock, by the way.
Benjamin Clough, the owner of the hauling horses, who said that the boys on the boat brought it in. Mr. Dunn gave evidence identifying his peacock and said that no one else in Methley even had a peacock, so it was obviously his. Mr. Dunn said he did not wish to press the case hardly against the defendants, and they were fined 21 shillings each or 1 month's imprisonment.
Gosh.
For stealing a lawyer's peacock.
Wow.
So solicitors have always had too much money and too little sense then, if they owned peacocks in 1890.
That's mad. Well, that did lighten the mood a little bit. Thanks for that.
It's okay.
Okay, so just to sort of round that up, without having looked into it literally at all, it must be sort of after this. So the last article in here on these documents is 1955.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if it was maybe around the 60s that people started having, in the simplest of terms, swimming lessons.
Yeah.
Where, like, public pools were a lot more accessible by the end of the 50s. Lidos, things like that.
I think it was...
And there's obviously, like, the decline of, like, mass industrialisation.
Yes. I feel like a lot of that stuff probably first popped up sort of, like, 1930s and 40s, the start of the Scout movement. Then we backed off that kind of stuff a little bit after Hitler Youth and the whole Nazi thing, and then we sort of re-approached
that whole Nazi thing.
Yeah, that whole thing, that huge thing. And then, yeah, I would imagine that certainly it becoming part of, like, state syllabus feels like something that probably came around about the 60s. I need to look into this more because I do find this sort of stuff really interesting.
Yeah, it is really interesting. Like, I think, obviously, the stories are interesting to me because I like, you know, like, sort of like the darker side of history, but I probably wouldn't have thought of it if you hadn't have brought it up that, like, these happened, like, literally every other day.
The frequency and then, is crazy.
And now, you know, you might hear, I mean, obviously it's still horrible, but you might hear of someone falling in the canal once a year.
I think
probably more than that, but definitely is in the news maybe once a year.
I think the general rule of thumb, it feels like, again, this is wildly loose and anecdotally, but I think there was possibly a period, it looks like in here, maybe in the late 1800s, 1900s, where per mile of waterway, you were probably fishing a body out a day. And just how prevalent death was.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot more ways to die.
Yeah.
Just life was a lot more perilous.
Yeah, a lot more brutal, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you so much for those. They were fabulous.
That's quite all right.
So at the end of each episode, I like to ask, what things have you been enjoying? Because it sometimes needs a little mood lightener, even though the peacock story was really good. So I usually ask, like, what people have been watching or listening to or reading.
Okay, yeah.
So is there anything that jumps into the front of your mind?
There is a YouTube channel that is, I think, the Japanese, like, public access television network. So it's like the Japanese NPR, I think, or whatever. And they have loads of really, really well-produced and lovely long documentaries about really interesting different parts of Japanese culture. The one I watched the other day was a father and son team who possibly look like the world's most talented restorers of The guy can literally take a 1,000-year-old bowl that's dropped onto the floor and smash it in 1,000 pieces and put it back together seamlessly, like you would never even know it's
so
been.
Cool.
No machinery, all hand done. So yeah, it's I can't remember the name of the channel, but if you search like Japanese public television, it's like there.
Yeah. If you send it to me, I will put it in the description.
Yes,
so people
thank
can
you.
Go and watch it.
Yes, I highly recommend checking it out. It's most of it's all subtitled, and then a lot of it is in English anyway. But really, really interesting and really good.
That's nice. That's a nice thing to sort of end on. I've just watched the newest series of Stranger Things, along with like literally everyone else in the world.
Yeah. I have watched the new Star Trek series, Strange New Worlds,
and
as a big fan of old Star Trek, it is thrilling to see modern Star Trek find its feet. It is incredibly good, so I would recommend it.
Oh, good. I'd recommend Stranger Things, you know, it's much of the same.
But
I don't think I need to because everyone's going to have watched it. I liked it.
I have not, so I'll maybe try to.
Maybe you should catch up. Oh, this is like literally the only thing that I am like up to date with, like that everyone else ever says to watch. I'm like, I haven't watched that, and then I'll watch it in 6 years or something when everyone's finished
cool.
with it. Yeah, I like
or
to think
slow.
So, but just I think slow is the. I think it's so slow. But what I should have mentioned is the big thing right at the beginning is that you have a podcast.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And that is also one of the first things that I knew about you.
Mm.
So, just before we go, when did you start the podcast and why did you start it?
I think about April 2020, and it was predominantly lockdown. It was just everything collided, and it was just like, now is the time. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I'm slacking a little bit. I need to finish. I'm halfway, three quarters of the way through my current season, and
yeah.
I've taken an impromptu break because mm-hmm. it's super fun to do, but can be quite taxing.
What I would say about Sean's podcast, which is called Leeds Echoes, and I think I did mention it in the first episode because you lent me a mic.
Yes,
first episode,
yes.
And I'm pretty sure that I mentioned it, but I will mention it again. So it's Leeds Echoes, and it's all different aspects of Leeds history, but your podcast is infinitely better produced than mine.
No.
And it is it's very professional, and it's just you doing sort of like 10-15 minute, you know, like very concise, very well researched monologue, I guess,
yeah,
about a particular
them,
thing.
Audio vignettes.
Yeah, that's
can
exactly
I
what
that?
They
I
are.
Loved that. I'd never have come up
yeah.
with that myself.
This is not what this is.
No, this is nice. I love different moods. I like how conversational yours is,
yeah.
And you have super interesting guests. It's not just me droning on.
Yeah. Oh, well, I think yours is great. So again, I will link that, and
that
I think that is quite a big part of your multifaceted.
It's a good combination of all the skills, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. A vignette. What was it?
Audio vignettes.
That's what they're. Audio vignettes.
That was someone on Radio 4 who described it like that.
So you've been on Radio 4. So already that is like infinitely better than. I don't know who's listening to this. Tell me who you are. I keep getting for my last episode, over about a week, I had 100 downloads, and I don't know who they're from. So if you listen to this and I don't know you, can you please send me a tweet?
So we can
at NoHeathenLand, so we can chat, please. Okay, I'm gonna leave it there because things are gonna get silly.
Okay.
So thank you so much, Sean.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an absolute pleasure.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
There we go. Episode 10. Thanks to Sean again for meeting and chatting with me for this episode. You can find Sean's day-to-day comings and goings and examples of his work, including gorgeous photography, on Instagram at warehouse606, and more about Sean's other work at www.warehouse606.com. As mentioned, Sean's podcast is called Leeds Echoes, and you can find it wherever you get your podcasts, just like this one. Thanks to you, whoever you may be, for listening. I would love to hear from you on my Twitter, at NoHeathenLand. Please come say hi. Give me suggestions for episodes. You know, whatever. Let's be friends. Until next time, take care. Bye-bye.